the Fleming Foundation.
Good afternoon. This is the Fleming Foundation. Today, with Thomas Fleming, we're going to be talking about some of the reasons that we're doing our summer symposium on the Victorian age. Tom, can you explain to us, give us some reasons why you've chosen this subject?
As people have pointed out, when I told them about this topic, they said, but you'll be the one who's all over the internet and on your website talking about how you don't believe in Generation X or the Beat Generation, and now you're talking about a specific historical period as if it has some meaning. But there, when we talk about things like the Gen Xers, we're talking about some special identity. In the case of the Victorian age, we're talking about a well-defined historical period like late Republican Rome or the Elizabethan England. And therefore, we have a right to look at their significance both for us and for others. One of the problems, though, with this kind of analysis is people get this idea that historical periods are airtight compartments. So if you lived in Republican Rome, then you wouldn't understand living in the early empire. Or if you lived in the early empire, you wouldn't understand what would happen like two generations later. And this is simply not the case. I think a lot of people, especially conservatives, their besetting sin is that they are trying to relive the experiences of their childhood. I think of this famous poem, American poem of Edward Arlington Robinson, which we used to have to memorize in school. You know, Miniver Cheevy, child of scorn, grew lean while he assailed the seasons. He wept that he was ever born, and he had reasons. Miniver loved the days of old when swords were bright and steeds were prancing. The vision of a warrior bold would set him dancing. Miniver sighed for what was not and dreamed and rested from his labors. He dreamed of Thebes and Camelot and Priam's neighbors. So we have to remember that there are a lot of holdovers and hangovers. And part of that significance is, you know, we ourselves are really the 20th and 21st century. We're still hung over from the Victorian period.
Well, the Victorian age is not just the age of Victoria. I mean, she did reign for a little over 60 years, but there was so much going on, both in terms of the context of what preceded that time. And in 60 years, the empire rose and fell.
Despite the fact that we think of, good Queen Victoria, who spent most of her time telling people she was not amused, it's a very important period from 1837 to 1901. Over in the United States, this corresponds to the period of presidencies from Martin Van Buren, who, as everybody remembers, succeeded Andrew Jackson, all the way to William McKinley. It includes the war between the states, the Mexican War, the Reconstruction, the Spanish-American War. In France, we have the July monarchy, and when the Bourbon monarchy was for a second time overthrown. So, you know, and in the German-speaking lands, it's a time of great revolution the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Hungarians, the Croats, and Serbs were all trying to liberate themselves from Austro-Hungarian rule. It's a very dynamic period of transition.
The one thing the English have going for them, though, is, and it's an overarching single monarch that told them she was not amused for the entire 60-year period.
And she had a pretty good time doing it. The 64 years. It's the second half of the 19th century, essentially, which, if you talk about generations are not 10-year periods. They're 30-year periods. And so two generations of people in England, but also the United States was very much still under the cultural spell of Great Britain. The age has, it's not just Victoria that puts her impress. To some extent, she's more a reflection than she is a dominant influence. There are certain characteristics to the period. She was born in 1819, this was only 4 years after the Battle of Waterloo, when the Duke of Wellington defeated Napoleon, and that ended the period of revolution and conquest for France and basically made Britain the most powerful nation in the world. The entire period of the 19th century lies under the shadow of the French Revolution and Napoleon. We would find it hard to understand, because Napoleon, for some people, represented one of the great heroes of history. For others, he was Adolf Hitler. You know, it was only Walter Scott's biography, which tried to be balanced, that began to restore Napoleon as anything but a kind of boogeyman. During the middle of her career, the revolutions of 1848 broke out all over Europe, in France, the Austro-Hungary, Hungarian Empire. And the failure of those revolutions to perpetuate themselves, is that was the seedbed of Karl Marx and Engels, and it was, in fact, their reflections on the failure of the Revolution of 48 that began to give rise to their form of socialism. Because previous efforts at socialism had been very utopian, pie in the sky, let's all get together and love one another right now. And with Marx, it became a disciplined way of looking at history as class struggle. And after all, only 16 years after her death came the Russian Revolution, when Marxism triumphed. Of course, Marxists today would say, oh, well, no, that wasn't real Marxism. Well, what about China? That wasn't real Marxism. What about, and finally, I finally said, well, I conclude that Pol Pot was the only real communist leader.
I'm amused by the modern day American socialists who tell the Cubans that they weren't doing it right.
Yeah, nobody does it right, because, you know, it's like if you're a unicorn breeder, nobody else has bred unicorns like you. That's true. That's true, because there's no such thing.
As an American, I don't think of the 19th century as the age of Victorian America, and I assume the rest of the world really didn't think that either. Is it really an age of revolution? I mean, is that really what was going on in the rest of the world?
Everywhere. I mean, the United States endured a revolution from basically 1860 to 1876, which transformed the United States from a confederation of sovereign and locally oriented states to a rapacious empire with central control governed by corrupt plutocrats. I mean, the difference between the United States under, say, Franklin Pierce and the United States under Ulysses S. Grant, these are two totally different countries. And unfortunately, conservatives today don't recognize that. So yeah, but it was not just political and economic revolutions, such as the revolutions of 1848. Of course, politically and economically, what we find is there are two revolutionary movements. The older revolutionary movement that helped to give birth to the French Revolution, and this basically becomes revolutionary liberalism, revolutionary capitalism, where you want to destroy the power of the monarchy, an organized church, aristocracy, class differences, cultural traditions, because all that matters is the unfettered individual's ability to get rich and to use his money any way he wants to. That was a very destructive revolutionary movement, say, summed up by people like Adam Smith. And it inevitably generated its enemy, revolutionary socialism, which, of course, is incredibly worse. But those two movements, which come to the fore and in the 19th century and have a death struggle by the end of the century, and, of course, socialism wins.
Are those the only revolutions that we're really talking about, economic?
No. It's the age of Darwin. I mean, Darwin turned the world upside down. I mean, yes, people had speculated on various evolutionary theories of the past, but it was Darwin, like Marx. Both of them, they weren't. Marx wasn't the first person to talk about class struggle or about utopia, about a socialist paradise, but he was the first person to give a sort of pseudo scientific determinism to it. Darwin's own grandfather had written a poem, Erasmus Darwin, in which he talked about the evolution of species. But Darwin went about it systematically in a disciplined way, and And social Darwinism, which was already sort of in the air before Darwin handed them the tools at their disposal, basically the survival of the fittest in the human world, so that rapacious plutocrats, powerful politicians, generals, would-be dictators. You know, if you read the early books of Jack London, you know, the like White Fang and things like that, you see everything is the struggle for survival. This grows directly out of their perception of Darwin. It's also the period in which the rising tide of atheism and religious skepticism, which is triumphant. A lot of people continued to sort of pretend to be Christian, but this is it's the period in which Christianity begins decisively to lose the battle, not just in the upper classes as it had in the 18th century, but across the board. When Nietzsche proclaimed that God was dead and predicted that man would not be able to endure this, this was in 1882. She still had 19 years left to reign. Feminism, of course, is the movement that takes over in this time. I mean, it started earlier in the 19th century, but feminist radicalism and demonstrations becomes characteristic of the Victorian age.
Well, the English were one of the first countries to give women the vote. Suffrage on that.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the end for them.
Well, wasn't there any opposition? I mean, didn't the old guard stand?
There was from a variety of places, and this is where it begins to get sort of interesting for us. First of all, you have the sort of the old Whig tradition, although it combined classical liberalism, that is an emphasis on freedom and moral responsibility, but it combined that with a concern for social order and dignity and cultural traditions, and some of those people made a very heroic stand against both the movements that were taking over. Henry Sumner Maine, a great jurist who in those days, but also Fitz James Stephen. Stephen had been a follower of John Stuart Mill, who became sort of the leader of the utilitarian movement, which is an offshoot of the classical liberals emphasizing the greatest good for the greatest number, an absolute nonsensical phrase. I remember when an economist friend of mine way back when said, what's wrong with that phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number? And I said, you can't maximize two variables. That's what's wrong with it. And he said, yeah. He said, why don't other people understand that? So the old Whigs had defeating, on the one hand, Bentham and Mill and the ideas of the French Revolution, and on the other hand, holding the line against communism.
Well, this whole time, the church that Henry VIII founded had to stand up against some of this, Darwinism and nihilism of Nietzsche.
Of course, if you are an Anglican, you would say that the church that Henry VIII liberated from Italian control and brought back to its roots. It's interesting that Henry VIII went to his grave. He was executing Protestants with as much glee as he was executing Catholics. He remained, theologically, he remained a Catholic, but he wanted no opposition. So, for example, one of the big movements in Victorian England is the so-called Oxford movement, when a number of very distinguished people, John Keble, Manning, and Newman, both of who became cardinals of the Catholic Church, Dr. Pusey, but these people were trying to restore the English church back to its Catholic roots. Some of them, of course, papped. Many of them did not and remained within the Anglican communion. But it was a lot of the more dignified traditions, which you can find still in remnants of the English church, go back to the fact that the Oxford movement was restoring them. My good friend John Reed, years ago, wrote a very nice book about the movement and what happened after its leading lights, Newman and Manning, when they became Catholic. We also paralleled, you know, in the history of the church is the papacy of Pius IX, who, of course, restored the Catholic Church to some of its former power and dignity.
Well, of course, for the Risorgimento, when the Italian government formed and unified the peninsula and seized all the all the church's lands.
When the industrial north of Italy conquered the agrarian south of Italy, robbed everything that wasn't nailed down, and impoverished half the country, and destroyed the estates of the church, which went back at least to the time of the Emperor Justinian. It was one of the most dastardly, villainous acts in modern history.
Well, when I read Trollope, who is firmly in the middle of the Victorian age, I get a sense of a very stable, pastoral, bucolic England. It has money flowing in from the colonies, and everybody's getting 250 pounds a year for them to exist on. Was it not like that?
It is interesting. You know, you have fox hunting parsons, and you have, you know, all the whole Barchester series, as well as the Palliser series about parliamentary politics. And I think Trollope probably gives us the best portrait of the period. But Trollope also wrote a novel which we're going to talk about in the summer school, The Way We Live Now. And it is a devastating portrait of financial corruption in the investment field, of every kind of financial chicanery. It's part of a general collapse of the class structure and of the standards of the aristocracy. Trollope, interestingly, satirizes both sides in England at the time, both the fuddy-duddy old conservatives like the Archdeacon Grantley in The Warden and Barchester Towers, but also in the Warden, which we will also be looking at, there's a liberal reformer who believes in justice and democracy and truth, John Bold, and he's just a pain in the backside. And if you allowed people like John Bold to run England, it would be the destruction of England. Interestingly, he puts everything, including friendship and loyalty, everything is secondary to justice as he perceives it. So there's a lot of running throughout Trollope is a very dry, tongue-in-cheek humor that you get at the expense. Anybody who's an extremist, either as a conservative or as a liberal, is going to find themselves under his scrutiny.
I'm amused by how both Trollope and Dickens describe characters that come so close to what we put up with today. And as in John Bold and the social justice workers that we have now, just that is the most important thing in the world.
Yeah.
So,
Jerks, the book I couldn't get my agent to sell.
Tell us about Dickens a little bit.
Dickens, on the one hand, had a lot of sappy sentimentalism and idealism, but in several of his books, he really gets down to the nub of what's going wrong in England, and it's industrialization, it's the takeover by the business classes from the landed and propertied aristocracy. In Bleak House, he's very hilariously satirizes philanthropy. There's this one lady, Mrs. Jellyby, who he says has a telescopic vision. She could see nothing closer than this little town in Africa, Buru Buru Ga or whatever, because her own family are in rags. They don't get fed. The house is dirty because she's busy raising money for somebody in Africa. I mean, talk about a contemporary figure. Hollywood is exemplified. And in Hard Times, which I think we'll have to read, Hard Times is a very hard look at the sort of the Manchester School of Economics, where all that matters are facts, all that matters is economic reality, and everything else must be sacrificed to it. And it's a portrait of a completely dehumanized society.
And if, what, the Wall Street Journal?
Yeah. If I had to put my money on who is the greatest social satirist of the age, I would probably put it on W.S. Gilbert of the famous opera writing team, Gilbert and Sullivan. Gilbert managed to satirize everything from court conventions, which he makes fun of in the Mikado, to the class system, but also to the whole idea of that democracy can overturn it. We get that in one of their earliest operas, that is The Pinafore. And we're going to be looking, I think, specifically at Princess Ida, which is a hilarious send-up of women's rights. The princess goes off and founds a university for women. And she's been engaged to a prince, and the country's going to go to war if she doesn't agree to marry him. And she doesn't care because she has these wacky ideas about women's education. When I was teaching a summer course at the University of Colorado, I was asked to, I was teaching a Latin course, and John Reed, who the singer, who had been the last of the great patter singers for the Dorlicard Opera Company, he every year directed one or two Gilbert and Sullivan operas at University of Colorado, and they put on Princess Ida. And Dr. Kopf and I went, and we in the program it said, they're only doing this for historical reasons, and there's nothing funny about a satire on women's education, much less a satire on Darwinism. Because the funniest song in the opera is a satire on Darwin. Alas, it is an hysterically funny opera. I already knew it well at the time, but we kept on guffawing and and that was years before the term it started circulating in universities. Inappropriate laughter. If somebody tells a joke about dumb women or something or whatever, and you laugh, you could get thrown out of school.
Mm. That all developed into the cancel culture.
Yes, exactly.
Have. Well, Tom, we've talked a lot about prose, and perhaps Gilbert and Sullivan makes a slight bridge to poetry. And I know that's one of your great loves. Why don't you tell us about what happened with poetry in the Victorian age?
Well, there's some very interesting poetry in the first half of the 20th century, but really the Victorian age is one of those great ages. Names like Tennyson, Browning, Matthew Arnold, these are three of the greatest poets in the history of the English language. They're imaginative. They can write moving short poems. They can also write narrative poems. They can write intellectual discourses. So something like Tennyson's In Memoriam, which was started out as an elegy for the death of his best friend. And yet, in the course of it, he goes over the great struggles, including Darwinism, that are tearing apart the world in Victoria's reign. It's a very moving and powerful piece. In many respects, it's exemplary of the Victorian age, because he can turn into incredibly beautiful verse these conundrums that people were facing. Poor Matthew Arnold. His father, Dr. Thomas Arnold, was the headmaster at Rugby, who revolutionized British public school education. Public schools meaning actually private schools that are acknowledged by the government to be have a the highest class of school. And Arnold created order where there had been chaos and violence. And his son, Matthew, became a very fine scholar, England's first great literary critic, and also a brilliant poet. In Arnold, you see a man of the highest character, the greatest nobility, and yet he believes in the Bible in the sense that he believes the Bible has answers for us, but he can't believe in anything supernatural. His father, for a while, had been troubled by the Trinity, but John Keble, the poet clergyman, had counseled him. But poor Matthew could never come back to the faith. And everything he saw in life was urban destruction of the landscape, the social destruction, simple people corrupted by, you know, consumerism, yet at the same time devoting himself, as he put it, the best that was ever thought or said or felt. And when a man without the consolations of faith and yet tried desperately to lead a Christian life and hold up the highest Christian values, he's a real inspiration. And by the way, G.K. Chesterton said that it was one of the greatest consolations was to read Arnold, because what he suffered, we all suffer, the doubt, the skepticism. the poets had to deal with the fact that the world of poetry, there were no fairies in the landscape now, no elves, no mini gods and goddesses. The shepherds and shepherdesses were gone. It was factories taking over, pollution, filth, exploitation of the working classes of the kind that inevitably produced the socialist response. And so we see this growing despair among poets with Blake and Wordsworth, then with Arnold and others, and finally coming out, they withdrawing more and more from reality, turning to art for art's sake, to beauty for its own sake, because the world is becoming ugly, and withdrawing. Or in Tennyson's case, writing narrative poems about King Arthur. What one after another, they withdraw into an imaginary world and produce things, works of great beauty, even down to the so-called aesthetes and decadents like Lionel Johnson and William Butler Yeats and Ernest Dowson. If you don't see it in the context, you keep people saying, oh, well, those guys were degenerates, they drank too much, maybe they smoked dope, they did this, they did that. And what they were looking for was to recover a beauty that once had been in the world and was now being destroyed. And let me read you a little bit from a little poem on Matthew Arnold. In a short poem, The Future, he talks about the way we live now and the way we're going to live. And he imagines time, the conventional phrase, time is a river. And he says, this tract, which the river of time now flows through with us, is the plain. That is, it's a level plain. It's not a mountain. It's not. There's nothing exciting. Gone is the calm of its earlier shore, bordered by cities and hoarse with a thousand cries in its stream. And we live, we on its breast, our minds are confused as the cries which we hear, changing and shot as the sights which we see. And we say that repose has fled forever the course of the river of time, that cities will crowd to its edge in a blacker, incessanter line, that the din will be worse on its banks, denser the trade on its stream, flatter the plain where it flows, fiercer the sun overhead, that never will those on its breast see an ennobling sight, drink of the feeling of quiet again.
That sounds very agrarian.
Well, it is. And in fact, what Arnold was taking up is a process. He was right. It's exactly what he was predicting. We live in the world. We're the offspring. We're the children of the Victorians still, 150 years later. What they saw in these early stages of development and what they were envisioning in Blake or later, of course, in Arnold, what they see is what is Tolkien's Mordor creeping across the face of the earth and finally issuing forth in New Jersey and Chicago, the world that we live in. So I would say one of the best ways of understanding some of the modern dilemmas that we face all the time is to begin to confront the thoughts of these people who, in a much greater way than we have, they saw from the beginning where things were going, and they stood up and tried to express something about it. They acknowledged these evils long before most people on the planet could conceive of them. And so people may think this is going to be a literary exercise. Well, yes, it will. We'll read a lot of great books. We'll confront a lot of deep thought in political philosophy, but we'll also see the origin of our own dilemma.
This was a presentation of the Fleming Foundation.